Ashman and the Redskins by George MacDonald Fraser. Continued. Cassette 3, Side 1.
Gold seekers, take heed. Our rubber boats and shelters are unsurpassed. You cannot face the chill of the gold rivers without a rubber suit. And water purifiers, an amazingly fangled machinery for washing gold dust. And they didn't sing any hymns about milk and honey and Canaan either. No, sir, it was a very different anthem, plunked out on a banjo by a young chap in a striped vest, with his girl dancing impromptu on a packing case, and everyone thumping the tailboards. I dare say you know the tune well enough, although it was new then, but I'll be bound you don't know the words the 49ers sang. I'll strip the mountains clean, my boys, and drain the rivers dry. A bucket full of rocks, bring home Susanna, don't you cry. Oh, California, that's the land for me. I'm off to Sacramento with my washbowl on my knee. Omnes fortissimo. Oh, Susanna, oh, don't you cry for me. I'm off to Sacramento with my washbowl on my knee. It was a raucous, ranting thing. But when I hear it now, in imagination, it's just a ghostly drift down the wind, fading into a whisper. But it was hearty enough then, and we sang it all the way down to Council Grove. I promised not to do a Greg or Park man, but I ought to tell you something of how we travelled. When we camped at night, we set guards. Wooten insisted, but I was all for it anyway, for you must do things right from the start. Susie and I slept in the carriage, which was as comfortable as Owens had promised, and the tarts saw the wagons close at hand. The drivers and guards had a couple of tents, although some preferred to doss down in the open. At breakfast and supper, and at the noon halt, Susie and I were waited on by a nigger servant. The tarts ate in their own wagons, and the guards messed at a discreet distance. Oh, we were a proper little democracy, I can tell you. I suggested that we might have Grattan over for supper one night, since he was a bit of a gentleman, or had been, but Susie wouldn't hear of it. "There are work folk," says she, holding a chicken leg with her pinky cocked, and guzzling down the burgundy. Now I saw why we'd bought such an unconscionable lot of it.
"If we encourage familiarity, they'll just presume, and you know where that leads? You finish up having to call in the militia to put them in their place, like New York. Anyway, that Nugent thingamy looks a right sly smart aleck to me. Whatever he may say about looking after my wenches and keeping them randy guards at arm's length, I'm glad I've got Marie and Stephanie on the QV.
"What's this?" says I, for I took a fatherly interest in the welfare of our fair charges.
"Marie and Stephanie," says Susie, "would rat on their own mothers, and the other little trollops know it. So there'll be no hanky-panky. Or if there is, I'll soon hear of it. And God help the backslider. She won't be able to sit down between here and Sacramento. I promise you that."
So, two of the tarts were Susie's pet spies, were they? That was useful to know. And lucky I'd found out before I'd done anything indiscreet. I could foresee circumstances where that knowledge might be useful. One acquaintance that I did cultivate, though, on the quiet trek to Council Grove, was Uncle Dick Wooten. He was a strange case. After our first meeting, he'd hardly said a word to me for days, and I wondered, was he sulking? But I soon discovered it was just a pensive shyness. He kept very much to himself with new acquaintances, although he could be genial and even garrulous when he got to know you. He was younger than I'd thought, and quite presentable when he'd shaved. However, down to Council Grove, he had no proper duties anyway. Grattan and I set the guards, and halts and starts seemed to determine themselves. When anything out of the way happened, like a river crossing, the teamsters and guards saw to it, and since there were good fords and the weather was dry, all went smoothly enough. So Wooten had no guiding to do, and he spent the time riding far out to flank, or some way ahead. He had a habit of vanishing for hours at a time, and once or twice I know he slipped out of camp at dusk, only to reappear at dawn. He ate all on his own, looking out across the prairie with his back to camp. Sometimes he'd sit on a hill for hours at a time, looking about him, or wander silent round the wagons, checking a wheel or examining the mule loads. I would catch his eye on me, occasionally, but he would turn aside and go off again, humming quietly to himself, for another prowl over the prairie. Then, one day, just after a noon halt, he trotted up to me and said, "Buffalo, Captain!" And I rode out with him a couple of miles to where a small herd of the beasts were grazing, the first I'd ever seen. I was for taking a shot at once, but he bade me hold on.
"Gotta pick a tender cow. Bull meat tough enough to build a shack this time of summer. Now see there, you take a sight the half finger width down from the hump, and a finger from the nose, or she'll carry a lead away for you. Gotta hit the heart or lungs. Now, Captain, you blaze away."
So I did, and the cow took off like a rocket and ran quarter of a mile, before she suddenly tumbled over, stone dead.
"Go on under," says Wotton. "You shoot sweet."
And as he skinned the hump very expertly and removed the choicest meat, he explained to me that a buffalo was damnably hard to kill, unless you hit it in a vital spot. I gathered I'd gone up in his estimation. I thought we'd drag the carcass back to the caravan, but he shook his head and set to roasting hump steaks over a fire. I've never tasted meat like that first buffalo hump. There's no beef to compare to it, and you can eat it without bread or vegetable, so delicious it is. Wotton also removed the intestines, and to my disgust grilled them gently by pulling them through the embers, whereafter he swallowed them in a great long string like some huge piece of spaghetti. I watched him in horror, or rather I didn't watch him, for I couldn't bear the grisly spectacle. Instead I turned my head aside and saw something infinitely worse. Not 20 yards away, on the lip of a little grassy ridge looking down on the hollow where we'd built our fire, 3 Indians were sitting their ponies, watching us. I hadn't heard them, or had the least intimation of their approach. Suddenly there they were, and I realized that the wretched, dirty creatures I'd seen at Westport, and scavenging round our train on the way down, were mere cartoon. These were the real thing, and my heart froze. The foremost was naked to the waist, with braided hair hanging to his belt, and what looked like a tail of coon's skin round his brows. The face beneath it was a nightmare of hooked nose and rat-trap mouth crossed by stripes of yellow paint. There were painted signs on his naked chest, and his only clothing was a white breech clout and fringed leggings that came to his knees. He had a rifle across his saddle and carried a long lance tufted with buffalo hair. Or at least I hoped it was buffalo hair. The other two were no better. They had feathers in their hair, and their faces were painted half red and white. They carried bows and hatchets, and like their leader, they were big, active, vicious-looking sons of bitches. But what truly scared me stiff was their sudden apparition, and the silent, dreadful menace in the still figures as they watched. I suppose it took me a couple of seconds to recover, but as my hand went to my pistol, Wotton's fingers closed on my wrist.
"Sit, Froze, Captain," says he softly. "Bully Sue. Friendly, kind of."
A fine reassurance, but Wotton seemed untroubled. You'll notice that even with his back turned, he knew they were there, and what they were. Now he turned his head and called out to them, and after a moment they dismounted and came slowly down to us. They looked even wickeder at close quarters, but they squatted down, and the leader raised a hand to Wotton and grunted something that sounded like a mortal insult, but was presumably a greeting. Wotton responded, while I sat stone still and kept my hand close to my pistol butt, nonchalant-like, which ain't easy with the fiend incarnate hunkered down a yard away, glaring with basilisk eyes out of a mask of paint, and you're uncomfortably aware that he's a muscular 6 feet of oiled and smelly savagery, with a hatchet like a polished razor on his hip. He and Wotton grunted some more at each other, and presently Wotton introduced us.
"This here, Spotted Tail," says he. "Big brave."
"How did he do?" says I. And to my surprise, he shook hands and made a noise between a snarl and a belch, which I took for civility. While he and Wotton talked, I studied the other two. If I'd known that the red dots on their feathers signified enemies killed, and the notches stood for cut throats, I'd have been even uneasier than I was. For that matter, Spotted Tail himself had 5 eagle feathers slanted through his pigtail. Each one, I learned later, stood for a scalp taken. Wharton was plainly asking questions, and the Indian answered with his slow grunts, accompanied by much deliberate gesture. Mighty graceful it was, too, and expressive. Even I could tell when he was talking of buffalo, just by the rippling motion of his hand, so like a bison herd seen from far off. A gesture which I noticed he repeated more than once was a quick cutting motion with his right fingers across his left wrist, which I later learned meant Cheyenne, whose nickname is Cut Arms. Then Wharton invited them to join him in his awful mess of buffalo guts, and much to the amusement of the other two, he and Spotted Tail had a nauseating contest in which each took an end of an immensely long intestine and gobbled away to see who could down the most of it. The Indian one, I spare you a close description, observing only that they swallowed whole, without chewing, and Spotted Tail, by suddenly jerking his head back, regained a fair amount that Wharton had already eaten. There being no dessert, I gave each of the three a cigar, at Wharton's prompting. They ate them, and presently went off, taking the remains of our buffalo carcass, without a by your leave. I've never been happier to get rid of dinner guests than said so. I seen their sign last night and figured they'd show today. Hunting party. First time I ever see Brulé's east of the nail show, says Wharton. In course they dogged the buffalo, but since they say themselves that there's a heap big herds all along the Arkansas, my guess is they're taking a lick at the Pawnees. They had a powerful lather of a million they were in for hunters. And I read sign of 50 ponies last evening. I reckon there'll be a few ponies talking to the old gentleman for long. Which meant the ponies would be dead and in hell. But were the Sioux liable to attack us? Wharton considered this long enough to give me the shudders. Can't say precisely. Spotted Tail has a straight tongue. Then again, Sioux can be mean varmints. Thought I was here, they'd had your house and traps for show, maybe your hair, too. But I guess they're peaceful enough. Uh-huh. Maybe. Now this had me in a rare sweat. I don't suppose until that day I'd given Indians a thought. Not seriously. It had been such a pleasant jaunt so far, and everyone in Westport had been so jolly and confident, and we still weren't more than a few days away from civilization, with its steamboats and stores and soldiers. And then, suddenly, those three painted devils had been there, and they were the peaceable ones, Wharton reckoned. And there were 1,000 miles of wilderness between us and Santa Fe, crawling with tribes of the dangerous bastards, who might be anything but peaceable. Stories and rumors and tall tales. You can take those with a pinch of salt and remind yourself that your caravan is well armed and guarded. And then you see the living peril in its hideous paint and feathers, and your dozen rifles and revolvers and 8 frail wagons seem like a cork bobbing out in a raging ocean. So I put it to him straight. What were our chances of winning as far as Santa Fe without serious interference? Not that it could make a damn bit of difference to me now. I was launched, and I daren't have headed back to be hunted in the Mississippi Valley. He scratched his head and asked me if I had a map. Look there, says he. Clear across to the Arkansas, we can rest pretty easy. Spotted Tail says there are plenty Cheyenne and Arapahoe lodges at Great Bend, and they're not hostile, for certain. But he talk of Navajo, Comanche, Kiowa war parties in the Cimarron country to the west. Says there be Apaches up as far as the Canadian, and Utes on the picket wire. Even talk of Bentons and Vrain leaving the big lodge. I believe that, what I said. But it's all uncertain. We can't tell here. Jesus, thinks I, so much for our picnic on the plains. But he cheered me up by remarking that Spotted Tail might be lying, it being well known that no Indian told the truth unless he couldn't avoid it. Also, we would be part of a much larger caravan from Council Grove onwards, and too powerful for any but a very large and reckless war party. We see when we get to the soldiers' new place at Fort Maine. Then we take a sniff of the wind and decide whether we go across the Cimarron Road to Sand Creek and the Canadian, or carry on west for Bence and down the Raton. He raised the blue eyes and suddenly smiled.
made the trip to Sandy Fee more times than he can recollect. This child has. And every time he got there and come back, if he can't make it again this time, Captain, he can slide.
Chapter 5.
There were 3 caravans waiting when we reached Council Grove, which proved to be simply a wood with a few shacks and a stable for the new stagecoach line. One of the caravans was a 20-wagon affair of young fellows, eastern clerks and labourers, calling themselves the Pittsburgh Pirates. Another was a train of some 30 mules and half a dozen emigrant families, also bound for the diggings. The third, and you may not believe this, but it's gospel true, consisted of 2 ancient travelling carriages and a dozen middle-aged and elderly valetudinarians from Cincinnati who were making a trip across the plains for their health. They had weak chests, and the pure air of the prairies would do them good, they said, clinging to their hot water bottles and mufflers and throat sprays as they said it. Well, thinks I, captaining a brothel on wheels may be eccentric, but this beats all. Wotton thought that among us we made a pretty fair train. Not as many guns as he would have liked, for the young fellows had set off in the crazy, thoughtless spirit that so many seemed to be possessed by in 49, and had only about 40 of weapons among them. And the emigrant families, although well armed and with 4 guards, were few in numbers. The invalids had 1 fat drunkard of a driver with a flintlock musket. If attacked, they presumably intended to beat off the enemy by hurling steam kettles and medicine bottles at them. Our own caravan had more firepower and discipline and general good order than all the rest put together, so they hailed us as they might salvation, and elected me captain of the whole frightful mess. My own fault for being so damned dashing in me buckskin shirt and whiskers, no doubt. Look the part and you'll be cast in it. I demurred modestly, but there was no competition, and one of the Pittsburgh pirates settled the thing by haranguing his fellows from a tailboard, crying that weren't they in luck, just, for here was Captain Coma, by cracky, who'd commanded a battleship in Her Majesty's English Navy, and fought the Arabs in India, and was just the man whose unrivaled experience and cool judgment would get everyone safe to California. Wasn't that so? So, I was elected by acclamation. None of your undignified running for office. And I read them a stern lecture about trail discipline, and obeying orders, and digging latrines, and keeping up, and all the rest of it. And they shook their heads because they could see I was just the man for the job. Susie, of course, was well pleased. It was fitting, she said. Wotton knew perfectly well that he was going to see the caravan through anyway, and Grattan and our crew were all for it, since he meant we could take the van and wouldn't have to eat the other's dust. So that was how we headed into the blue, Flash's caravan of whores and optimists and bronchial patients and frontiersmen and plain honest-to-goodness fortune-seekers. I don't say we were a typical wagon train of 49, but I shouldn't be surprised. Now, I promised to skip the tedious bit, so I'll say only of the prairie trek in general, that it takes more weeks than I can remember, is damnably dull, and falls into 2 distinct parts in my memory. The first bit, when you haven't reached the Arkansas River, and just trudge on 15 miles a day or thereabouts, over a sea of grass and bushes and prairie weeds. And the second bit, when you have reached the Arkansas, and trudge on exactly as before. The only difference being that now you have one of the ugliest rivers in the world on your left flank, broad and muddy and sluggish. Mind you, it's a welcome sight in a dry summer, and you're thankful to stay close by it. Thirst and hunger have probably killed more emigrants than any other cause. There's little to enliven the journey, though. River crossings are said to be the worst part, but with the water low in the creeks, we had little trouble. Apart from that, we sighted occasional Indian bands, and a few of them approached us in search of whatever they could mooch. There were a couple of scares when they tried to run off our beasts, but Grattan's fellas shot a couple of them, Pawnees, according to Wotton, and I began to feel that perhaps my earlier fears were groundless. Once the mail coach passed us, bound for Santa Fe, and a troop of dragoons came by from Fort Mann, which was being built at that time.
For the rest, the most interesting thing was the litter of gear from trains that had passed ahead of us. It was like all the left luggage offices in the world, strewn out for hundreds of miles. Broken wagons, traces, wheels, bones of dead beasts, household gear and empty bottles were the least of it. I also remember a printing press, a ship's figurehead of a crowned mermaid, a grand piano. That was the one stuck on a mud bank at the middle crossings, which Susie played to the delight of the company, who held an impromptu barn dance on the bank. A kilt and 12 identical plaster statues of the Venus de Milo. You think I'm making it up? Check the diaries and journals of the folk who crossed the plains, and you'll see that this isn't the half of it. But it was always too hot, or too wet, or too dusty, or too cold, especially at nights. And before long, I was heartily sick of it. I rode a good deal of the time, but often I would sit in the carriage with Susie, and her chatter drove me to distraction. Not that she moped, or was ill-tempered. In fact, the old trot was too damn bright and breezy for me, and I longed for Sacramento and goodbye, my dear. And in one respect, she didn't travel well. We beat the mattress regularly as far as Council Grove and a bit beyond. But after that, her appetite for Adam's arsenal seemed to jade a trifle. Nothing was said, but what she didn't demand, she didn't get. And when I took to sleeping outside, for the coach could be damn stuffy, she raised no objection. And that became my general rule. I gave her a gallop every so often to keep her in trim. But as you will readily believe, my thoughts are long since turned elsewhere, viz., to the splendid selection of fresh black batter that was going to waste in our two lead wagons. Indeed, I thought of little else since we left Orleans. The question was how to come at it. You've learned enough of our travel arrangements to see how difficult it was. Indeed, if I had to choose the most inconvenient place I've ever struck for conducting an illicit amour in privacy and comfort, a prairie wagon train would come second on my list, no question. An elephant howdah during a tiger hunt is middling tough. Center stage during amateur theatricals would probably strike you as out of court altogether, in Gloucestershire anyway. But it's astonishing what you can do in a pantomime horse. No, the one that licked me was a lifeboat. After a shipwreck, that is. But a wagon train ain't easy. However, when you've committed the capital act, as I have, in the middle of a battle with Borneo headhunters, you learn to have faith in your star and persevere until you win through. My first chance came by pure luck. Somewhere between Council Grove and the Little Arkansas. We'd made an evening halt and lagered, as usual, and I'd wandered out a little piece for a smoke in the dusk, when who should come tripping across the meadow but Aphrodite, humming to herself as usual. She was the big shiny black one who'd spotted me that day back in New Orleans. I thought then that she was one of those to whom business is always a pleasure, and I was right. What was she doing so far from the wagons, unchaperoned by one of her sisters in shame? I didn't inquire. You don't look a gift horse in the mouth, or a gift mare, either. She stopped short at sight of me, and I saw the eyes widen in that fine ebony face. She glanced quickly towards the distant wagons, where the fires were flickering, and then stood, head down, shooting me little glances sidelong, scared at first, and then smoky as she realized that, however terrible Susie might be, it might be no bad thing to satisfy the love light in Massa's eye. I nodded to a dry buffalo wallow under some nearby bushes, and without a word she began to undo her bonnet strings, very slow, biting her lip and shaking out her hair. Then she sauntered down into the wallow, and when I came ravening after her, pushed me off, playful-like, murmuring, "Wait, Mr. Beachy, just you wait now." So I did, while she slipped off her dress and stood there naked, hands on hips, turning this way and that and pouting over her shoulder. She was well-named Aphrodite, with those long, black, tapering legs and rounded rump and lissom waist. And when she turned to face me, wriggling her torso, well, I've never looked at a pumpkin since without thinking, buffalo wallow. pretty teeth she had, too, gleaming in that dusky face. And she knew how to use them. I drew her down and we went to work side-stroke-like, while she nibbled and bit at my ears and chin and lips, gasping and shuddering, like the expert trollop she was. I remember thinking, as she gave her final practiced heave and sob, Susie was right. With another 19 like this, we'll be able to buy California after a year or two. Maybe I'll stay about for a while. She was too much the whore for me, though. Once was enough, and although she shot me a few soulful, sullen looks in the weeks that followed, I didn't use her again. I'm not just an indiscriminate rake, you see. I like to be interested in a woman in a way that is not merely carnal, to find out new fascinations in her with each encounter, those enchanting, mysterious, indefinable qualities, like the shape of her tits. And having studied the other 19, as opportunity served, weighing this attraction against that, considering such vital matters as which ones would be liable to run squealing to Susie, and which were probably the randiest, I found my mind and eye returning invariably to the same delectable person. There wasn't one among them that wouldn't have turned the head of the most jaded roué. Trust Susie for that. But there was only one who could have brought me back for a 20th helping, and that was Clearney. For one thing, she had style in the way that Montez and Alice Keppel and Co. Darley's daughter and Cassie and Lakshmi Bai, and perhaps three others that I could name, had it. It's the thing which, allied with ambition and sense, can give a woman dominion over kings and countries. Thank God my Elspeth never had the latter qualities. She'd not have married me, for one thing. But Elspeth is different, and always will be. Also, Clearney was a lady, and if you think a whore can't be that, you're wrong. She was educated, convent-bred, possibly, and spoke perfect English and better French. Her manners were impeccable, and she was as beautiful as only a high-bred octoroon fancy can be. With a figurehead like St. Cecilia, and a body that would have brought a stone idol howling off its pedestal. Altogether fetching, and intelligent enough to be persuadable, in case she had any doubts about accommodating Damaso with the moustache on his face. But I would have to go to work subtly and delicately. Spring's pal Agag would have nothing on me. So, I bided me time, and established a habit of occasionally talking, offhand, to various of the tarts, in full view of everyone, so that if I were seen having a few words with Clearney, no one would think it out of the way. I did it pretty stiff and formal, very much the master, and even remarked to Susie how this one or that was looking, and how Claudia would be the better of a tonic, or Eugenie was eating too much. She didn't seem to mind. In fact, I gathered she was pleased that I was taking appropriatorial interest in the livestock. Then I waited until one noon halt, when Clearney went down to the river by herself. She was perhaps the least gregarious of them all, which was all to the good, and loafed along to where she was breaking twigs and tossing them idly into the stream. When she saw me, she straightened up and dropped me a little curtsy, preparing to withdraw. We were screened by the bushes, so I took her by the arm as she went past. She gave a little start, and then turned that lovely nun's face towards me, without fear, or any emotion at all that I could see. I took her gently by the two braids of hair that depended from that oddly attractive centre parting, and kissed her on the lips. She didn't move, so I kept my mouth there, and slipped a hand onto her breast, to give her the idea. Then I stepped back to gauge her reaction. She stood, looking at me, one slim hand up to her lips where mine had been, and then turned her head in that languid duchess fashion, and said the last thing I'd have expected.
"And Aphrodite?"
I almost jumped out of my skin. I gargled some intelligent inquiry, and she smiled and looked up at me from under her lids.
"Has Master tired of her? She will be disappointed. She..."
"Aphrodite!"
says I, distraught. "I'd better shot her big black gob, hadn't she? What's she been saying, the lying slut?" "Why, that master took her and made much of her."
"Christ! Look here, to Marie and Stephanie, now."
"We all know that is if Aphrodite is to be believed."
She gave me an inquiring look, still with that tiny smile.
"I myself would have thought she was rather black and heavy for master's taste. But some men prefer it, I know."
She gave a little shrug.
"Others?"
She left it there, waiting. I was taken all aback, but one thing was foremost. "What about Stephanie and Maria? I thought..."
"That they were mistress's sneaks?"
She nodded.
"They are little telltales. And if it had been anyone but master, they would have told her right away. But they would not readily offend you. None of us would."
And she lowered her lids. Her lips quivered in amusement.
"Stephanie is very jealous, even more than the rest of us, if that is possible."
And she gave me a look that was pure horror. By George, I tingled as if I'd been stung.
"But I should not stay here."
And she was making past me when I caught her arm again. "Now look here, Clearney," says I. "You're a good girl, I see. So, at the evening halt, you follow me down to the river, carefully mind, and we'll have a little talk. And you tell the others that if anyone blabs, it'll be the worse for them, do you hear?" I almost added the threat I'd prepared in case she'd been difficult, that if she didn't play pretty, I'd tell Susie she'd made advances to me. But I guessed it wasn't necessary.
"Yes, Master Beauchamp,"
says she, very demure, and turned her head languidly.
"And Aphrodite?"
"Hell with Aphrodite," says I, and took hold of her, nuzzling. She gave a little laugh and whispered,
"She smells so, does she not?"
And then she slipped out of my grasp and was away. Well, here was capital news and no mistake. Jealous of Aphrodite, were they? And why not, the dear creatures? Mark you, well, I've never been modest about my manly charms. I could see now what it was. They were a sight more concerned to be in my good books than in Susie's. Being green wenches, they supposed that I would be calling the tune henceforth, and no doubt they figured it was worth the risk of her displeasure to keep in with me. That was all they knew. In the meantime, Miss Clearney was obviously more than willing, and they'd never dare to peach. On that score, would it be a good notion to scare 'em sick by telling Susie that Aphrodite had tried to seduce me? Susie would flog the arse off her, which would be fine encouragement pour les autres to keep their trap shut. On t'other hand, Aphrodite would certainly tell the truth of it, and Susie just might believe her. It would sow a seed for sure. No, best leave it, and make hay with my high yellow fancy while the sun shone. And I did. She was a smart girl, and since I was sleeping out most of the time, it was the simplest thing for her to slip over the tailboard in the small hours, creep into my little tent, and roger the middle watch away. We were very discreet, not more than twice a week, which was just as well, for she was an exhausting creature, probably because I was more than a mite infatuated with her. The plague was, it all had to be in the dark, and I do like to see the materials when I'm working. She had a skin like velvet, and pounces as firm as footballs with which she would play the most astonishing tricks. It was a deuced shame that we couldn't risk a light. But her most endearing trait was that while we performed, she would sing, in the softest of whispers, of course, with her mouth to my ear, as we surged up and down. This was a new one to me, I'll own. Lola and her hairbrush, Mrs. Mandeville and her spurs, Ran Avalona's swinging uppercuts and right crosses. I'd experienced a variety of bizarre behaviour from females in the throes of passion. My darling Elspeth now gossiped incessantly. With Clearney it was singing, a lullaby to begin with, perhaps, followed by a waltz, and the Marche Lorraine, and finishing with the Marseillaise, or if she was feeling mischievous, Swanee River. Thank God she didn't know any Irish jigs. She was an excellent conversationalist, by the way, and I learned things, in whispers, which explained a good deal. One was that the whores were by no means in mortal dread of Susie, who had never caned one of them in her life, for all her stern talk. The one who'd been sold downriver had been a habitual thief. Indeed, they held her in deep respect and affection, and I gathered that being bought for her bordello was a matter of close competition among the Orleans fancies, and about as difficult as getting into the household brigade. No, the one they were in terror of, apparently, was me.
You look so fierce and stern,
Clarny told me,
and talk so shortly to the other girls. Aphrodite says you used her most brutally. Me, I said, mais naturellement, how else would master use an animal? With females of refinement, I told her, he is of an exquisite gentleness and tender passion.
She sighed contentedly.
Ah, but they are jealous of me, those others, and yet they cannot hear enough about you. What? But of course I tell them. What would you? Scholars talk about books, bankers about money, soldiers about war. What else should our profession talk about?
Never thought of that. Still, even if she was delivering a series of lectures on flashy et ars amatoria to her colleagues, I can say that I had an enchanting affair with Clarny, grew extremely fond of her, and placed her about 7th or 8th in my list of eligible females, which ain't bad, out of several hundreds. But it wasn't all recreation along the Arkansas that year. I beguiled the long hours of trekking with Wooten, whose lore included a fair fluency in the Sioux language, and the Mexican Sabaneros, who had charge of our mules, and naturally spoke Spanish. As I've already said, I'm a good linguist. Burton, who was no slouch himself, said that I could dip a toe in a language and walk away soaked. And since I had some Spanish already, I got pretty fluent. But Siouan, although it's a lovely, liquid language, is best learned from a native Indian, and Wooten taught me only a little. Thank heaven for the gift of tongues, for a few words can mean the difference between life and death, especially out west. Of course, things were going far too well to last. Aside from our first alarming meeting with the Brulés, and the night's scare with the Pawnees, which I slept through, we'd had nothing worse than broken axles by the time we got to Fort Mann, the new military post which lay in the middle of nowhere, on the Arkansas, about halfway to Santa Fe by the shortest route. That was where the trouble started. For the past week, we'd become aware of increasing numbers of Indians along our line of march. There had been, as Wooten predicted, villages of Cheyenne and Arapaho near the Great Bend, but they'd mostly been on the southern bank, and we'd kept clear of them, although they were reputedly friendly. We would see parties of them on the skyline, and once we met a whole tribe on the move, heading south across our line of march. We halted to let them go by, a huge, disorderly company, the men on horses, the women trudging along, all their gear dragged on the travois poles which churned up the dust in a choking cloud. A herd of mangy ponies behind being urged on by half-naked boys, and cur dogs yapping on the flanks. They were a poor, ugly-looking lot, and their rank stench carried a good half mile. There were more camped about Fort Mann, and Wooten went out to talk to them when we lagered. He came back looking grim and took me aside. It seemed that the party he'd talked to were Cheyenne from a great camp some miles beyond the river. There was a terrible sickness among them, and they'd come to the fort for help. But there was no doctor at the fort, and in despair they'd asked Wooten, whom they knew, for assistance. "We can't do anything," says I. "What, doctor? A lot of sick Indians? We've nothing but jalap and sulphur, and it'd be poor business wasting it on a pack of savages. Anyway, God knows what foul infection they've got. It might be plague."
"'Pears it's a big gripe in their innards," says he. "No festering sores, nothing that away, but they're keeling over in windrows," the chief says, "and he reckons we got medicine men in our train who could—" "Who, in God's name? Not our party of invalids. Christ, they couldn't cure a chilblain. They can't even look after themselves. They've been wheezing and hawking all the way from Council Grove. Cheyenne don't know that, but they see the gear and implements on the coaches. See them coons doctoring themselves with them squirt machines. They want them doctor their people, too. Well, tell them we can't, damn it. We've got to get on. We can't afford to mess with sick Indians. He gave me the full stare of those blue eyes. Captain, we can't afford not to. See, hay is the way on it. Cheyenne, about the only real friendlies on these here plains. Without them, if they die or go away, we get bad Indian trouble. That's the best side on it. At worst, we give them the go-by. They don't forget. Could be we even have them kayaking round our wagons with paint on. And there's 3,000 on them across the river, in Osage and Rapahoo to boot. That a powerful heap of Indian, Captain. But we can't help them. We're not doctors, man. They can see us trying, says he. There was no arguing with him, and I'd have been a fool to try. He knew Indians, and I didn't. But I was adamant against going down to their camp, which would be reeking with their bloody germs. Let them bring one of their sick to the far bank of the river, and if it would placate them for one of our invalids to look at him, or put up a prayer, or spray him with carbolic, or dance in circles round him, so be it. But I told him to impress on them that we were not doctors and could promise no cure. "They best hear it from you," says he. "You, big chief, wagon captain." And he was in dead earnest, too. So now, you see, big chief wagon captain standing before a party of assorted nomads, palavering away with a few halting Sioux phrases, but Wooten translating most of the time, while I nodded, stern but compassionate. And I wasn't acting either. One look at this collection and I took Wooten's point. They were the first Cheyenne had ever seen close to, and if the Brule Sioux had been alarming, these would have put the fear of God up Wellington. On average, they were the biggest Indians I ever saw. As big as I am, great massive shouldered brutes with long braided hair and faces like Roman senators. And even in their distress, proud as grandees,